Page 94, the Private Eye podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray and this is our annual Paul Foot Awards spectacular special. Yet again, unfortunately, it is a party from home. But if you are able to join us, then please open the nearest available drink and settle in for some fabulous works and feats of investigative and campaigning journalism. The Paul Foot Award, for those of you who haven't heard one of these before, is the Eye's annual award for investigative and campaigning journalism. It was established in memory of the late great Eye journalist Paul Foot, who died in 2004, and it exists to reward extraordinary feats of journalism. This year's shortlist is packed, as every year's shortlist is, with brilliant stories, features, investigations, and campaigns by some of the best journalists working in the country today. It's obviously been a very unusual year for news, not only because so much of the news has revolved around coronavirus, but also because so many of the stories have been produced under extraordinary conditions. Working from home is not an ideal way to talk to sources, make new connections, finally get stories to stack up. Nonetheless, all of the seven stories and investigations shortlisted this year have managed to do just that. We're going to be speaking to the journalists behind each and every one of them, and at the end of the show, we will be going over to Ian Hislop, who will be announcing the winner. So, without further ado, let us see who is first in the pipeline of news. Over to them.
My name is Peter Gagan, and I am the investigations editor at Open Democracy UK.
My name is Jenna Corduroy, and I'm investigative reporter for Open Democracy.
Jenna Corduroy, Peter Gagan, can you tell us about the story that's brought you to the Paul Foot Awards?
Well, yes, this is a story that in many ways has been a long time in gestation. It started back in August 2018, when we started looking into a thing called a clearinghouse, which is this unit, a kind of slightly Orwellian name, a unit in the Cabinet Office that's involved with vetting FOI requests. So basically, if you're a journalist or any member of the public, whoever sends in an FOI request, there's a potential, if you send it to multiple government departments, what they call a round-robin request, or if it's seen as particularly sensitive, it can get sent to this clearinghouse unit to kind of figure out how it should be replied to. And we came interested in this because we could find very little information about this. We'd heard talk of it, you know, kind of little bits of wisps. You know, there's a bit of a reference to it in an old BBC article. A kind of ever so slight, an academic journal might make a passing reference to it. And we use a lot of FOI. We're very interested in it, very passionate about it. We went, okay, what's going on with it? So we started digging into it. And in many ways, you know, as often as a journalist, you think you're maybe trying to find a little bit more information about something. We didn't really think that 3 years later we'd probably be talking to you at the Paul Foot Awards about it. But that's where the story kind of snowballed from. We started to try and get a bit of, well, it took us a very long time to get any clarity. We only ended up publishing on this story last December. So over 2 years after we initially started sending FOIs, wow, to try and understand this clearinghouse, asking basic questions, you know, how does the clearinghouse work? What kind of guidance have you got? And it took us, you know, a long time to get any responses, but even then to try and get a handle on what was going on. And what we found was going on, I think, in many ways was really concerning. We discovered that, you know, a lot of journalists, the bulk of these, what the clearinghouse kind of is dealing with, a bulk of it comes from journalists. Journalists, campaigners, researchers, others, their names were all are all added to what's called a clearinghouse list that's sent around Whitehall every day to kind of to show whoever's to see who's been making FOI requests. So that alone is a red flag, and data protection experts think that that might be breaking the law. But also we discovered that this unit was telling departments how to respond to FOI requests. So, you know, FOI is supposed to be applicant blind. It means that whoever makes the request, it doesn't matter. We should all have access to information. The government tells us it's applicant blind, but what we were able to see was that at the heart of government, in the very middle of government, in the unit that's supposed to be in charge of FOI, the Cabinet Office, something really concerning was going on.
Jenna, how did you find the process of reporting on this story? Were there substantial roadblocks put in your way? Was there a lot of secrecy about the operation of this clearinghouse?
Yeah, so unfortunately, the Freedom of Information process is an incredibly frustrating and long process, and I think that our experience of, you know, trying to access information about the clearinghouse meeting and the request in August 2018 and, you know, not having, you know, and having to go to the tribunal in April 2021.
Wow.
I mean, that just encapsulates how the FOI process is like in the UK at this point in time. So it has been frustrating, slightly terrifying when you're cross-examined at a tribunal. But I truly believe that this fight has been in the public interest.
I think it's a really interesting story because one of the things that private eye journalists have experienced is a slight degradation of the freedom of information process. It has been getting harder to access the information that everyone should have a right to. And Jenna, I was wondering if you could tell me, are there specific examples of freedom of information requests that have been declined, partly thanks to the work of this clearinghouse, and information that should be in the public domain?
So Jason Evans, he has been campaigning for justice around the infected blood scandal. And he is not only an incredible campaigner, but he is an incredible person trying to access documents under the Freedom of Information Act. He uses it very regularly for his work. He sent in a Freedom of Information request to the Treasury asking for files on the infected blood scandal. And he experienced a lot of delays. He didn't get a substantial response until 5 months later from the Treasury. But then in further documents that we've seen and disclosed under the Freedom of Information Act, he actually asked for, the internal comms around the handling of that initial request to the Treasury. Mm. And it turned out that the Treasury had sent the Freedom of Information request to the clearinghouse to get their views on it. And, at the time, I just didn't know that that process was happening. And the internal documents you see is this continual back and forth between the Cabinet Office and the Treasury, effectively saying that the Treasury should not disclose the information that he's seeking. And I believe in quite a very underhand way.
Yeah, I think it's, what we can see in Jason's case, this is somebody whose father died in tragic circumstances after being given contaminated blood with HIV, and he was trying to understand what's happened. And the Treasury wants to give him this information. The Treasury says, look, we want to do this. But it's having, because of the way the system has now been set up, it has to engage with this clearinghouse. It doesn't have an option. Because this is seen as a sensitive issue, this is something that's potentially embarrassing for the government. And I think it's really interesting, and I think we're only really scratching the surface now on the number of people that this has happened to. Jason's story is one story, but it's really important to remember, FOI is not just for journalists. It's not just an optional extra. It's a piece of law. Your government shouldn't have the choice to do this. It's created so citizens can find out bits of information that are germane to them, or just germane to issues that they care about. And this clearinghouse that we can see, and as I mentioned it earlier, but it's worth remembering, the Cabinet Office is the department in charge of FOI policy. It's supposed to be the government department that's pushing transparency. The Cabinet Office has got the worst record in the entire British state apparatus for FOI responses. Any journalist who's ever engaged with the Cabinet Office will know this. They will not respond to anything. And that is a huge, huge, huge problem. And that, it's the reason why we've kept on with this story in many respects. And the Cabinet Office, Michael Gove has personally called our reporting tendentious and ridiculous. At the same time as he was saying this, privately, before the submissions through this tribunal that we had heard just in April, which has just been published a judgment on, the Cabinet Office was backtracking, actually, and realising, oh no, we've made a real, real issue here. In their submission to this tribunal, they included to say that there was the public knew about this, we weren't being secretive about it. The reference was to a gov.uk website that hadn't been updated in 8 years and an out-of-date Wikipedia page. No, needless to say, I will. Full disclosure, the Cabinet Office Press Office did come back to us saying, no, actually, there was an old BBC article, some academic journals, and it's been mentioned in the House too. So you've had your transparency, folks. It's all there for you.
It feels like the moment at the beginning of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy where he says, no, the planning decision to destroy your house was on display in the basement of a disused council building in
exactly
a locked filing cabinet. Yeah, goodness me. Well, it sounds like the story has a lot further to run. And is there anything that you're looking forward to seeing coming next?
I would just say more stories on this. And I think it's nice that fellow journalists and MPs have definitely raised noises about our work, which is really nice considering I got into Freedom of Information in 2012, 2013. I thought this is a brilliant tool to try and get hold of information. And then to see it slide and hearing people's struggles in trying to get information. So this is, for me, this is a really nice thing to see.
I'm Jonathan Calvert. I'm the editor of this Sunday Times Insight team. And I'm George Abuthnot, and I'm the deputy editor of the Insight team.
It's an investigation into the government's handling of the coronavirus crisis, which we began back in April last year. It was about the Prime Minister's 38 lost days in tackling the virus, and we revealed that he hadn't been to any COBRA meetings, he hadn't taken the threat of the virus very seriously, there had been no attempt to really kind of hit the ground running by kind of increasing our PPE or our testing ability. And this was all the more marked because the years of Brexit and austerity had kind of caused our pandemic planning, which was supposed to be the best in the world, to be in a very, very poor state.
That first story, the 38 days when Britain sleepwalked into disaster, was such a huge and comprehensive account and produced quite early. It's also a very complicated story because of the sheer number of moving parts. How did you define your terms?
Yeah, it was a broad remit that we were given. It was quite a simple remit. It was just to look at those January and February and see what the government had done in readiness, because we could see that the Prime Minister had gone off on holiday in the middle of February, and he certainly didn't seem to have made many public statements about the issue, even though there were the unbelievably alarming signs, you know, from China, from Wuhan, where they were building hospitals to try and tackle the thing. So what we did is we initially just produced a very detailed timeline going through that period of everything that was in the public domain. By doing that, we then identified the crucial people that we needed to reach out to who would have more information, and also amongst the scientists. We also actually managed to get hold of a Downing Street whistleblower who was really shocked at the lack of care and attention the Prime Minister had been giving the subject, and that was certainly very helpful. And they gave us huge amounts of information, which we then had to try and corroborate with other documentary evidence and other testimony from witnesses. So it was quite a frenzied. I actually get coronavirus symptoms as well during the weeks into the article. So, but that was actually quite helpful because I couldn't help with the kids, so I was just in my bedroom. Isolated, so it kind of made it more concentrated, I suppose, my attention to the subject.
Well, that is an extremely optimistic way of looking at it, having to report on the thing while you've got it. So that's how the investigation started, if you like, although that was the early phase of it. Can you tell me about how it progressed as the year went on and as lockdowns came and went?
Yes, so our second article was about the implications of the first late lockdown in March, and we got hold of some backdated modelling from Oxford University and Imperial College London, which had never been published before, which showed the exponential growth of the virus in those final 9 days up to lockdown. And so what we looked at was there had been, you know, the scientists had been a bit unclear, or certainly had been proponents of a kind of delay approach to the restrictions, but what was clear was that by the 14th of March, the government had realised, and I mean, Dominic Cummings has since made that clear, that they needed to change tack and there needed to be a lockdown. But Johnson delayed that for a further 9 days, and what we could see from the backdated modelling was that infections went from 200,000 across the UK on the 14th of March to 1.5 million on the 23rd of March. And so that strongly suggested that the vast majority of the deaths in that first wave were caused by Boris Johnson's dither and delay in that final week. The next article was about the appalling consequences of that late lockdown and the fact that so many people died without the care they needed. There was a kind of triage system that was used in hospitals, which meant that very few people over the age of 75 actually ever got into intensive care. And something like 1 in 9 of all people who died of the virus in the first wave got into had ICU care, so it clearly showed that the vast majority of people actually did not have given the chance or the potentially life-saving treatment that they could have had. And then we looked at the second late lockdown and spoke to a lot of sage scientists who were just absolutely gobsmacked that having made the mistake of a late lockdown once in that first wave, to then make the same mistake twice in September and October was just absolutely unforgivable. And so we looked at the warnings the government's been given about that and the sheer number of people that the Prime Minister had ignored in that decision. As Cummings has said, you know, he was strongly pushing for it. Several members of the cabinet were, Sage were absolutely adamant that this needed to happen. The World Bank had said that by delaying lockdown, you not only cost lives, but you also cause more economic damage in the long run because you then have to have a longer lockdown. And of course, that's been proved correct because we ended up having to be locked down for the entire winter. So that was in December. We wrote that article in December and we were astonished that they made that mistake again. But then, of course, we then went on to make the same mistake for a third time in January by delaying that lockdown as well. And that led to the worst, most devastating situation, which was almost twice as bad as the first wave.
Do you think there are more stories to come out from this period that we haven't heard yet?
There probably is quite a lot more to come out on the first year, which was quite an interesting period. I mean, I think we've learned certain things which are quite gobsmacking. For example, Dominic Cummings saying that the Prime Minister didn't believe that the first lockdown, he should have had the first lockdown, which is an extraordinary statement. Just imagine how many people would have died had he not brought in the first lockdown. And we're very much feel that, you know, there should be an inquiry now, not next year, to look into all this decision making, because it seemed to get worse and worse and worse through the year. I mean, when we went into lockdown the first time, there were 7,000 people in hospital. When we went into lockdown at the beginning of November, there were 14,000, and then by the time we went into lockdown on January the 4th this year, there was something like 30,000 people in hospital, which the decision making seemed to get worse each time. The thing people miss about that is by allowing infections to get so high, it causes huge numbers of deaths that could otherwise have been avoided. And that's why an inquiry is really important.
I'm Pippa Creera and I'm political editor at the Daily Mirror.
Pippa, can you tell me a little bit about the story that brought you here? And I appreciate it will be a story that everyone will know as soon as you mention it.
Yes, it was the Mirror and the Guardian's investigation into Dominic Cummings breaking lockdown rules and heading up to the northeast of England. And of course, that now infamous day trip to Barnard Castle.
And how did the story first appear to you? Was it members of the public getting in touch?
So a contact of mine got in touch with me saying that friends of theirs had seen Dominic Cummings up out and about in County Durham. It was passed on as a sort of, this is a tip, this is something I've heard, my friends are adamant, they know what he looks like, they know who he is, but I'm just passing on to you, I don't know whether it's true or not. And of course that is our job then to try and pursue that. So, you know, first thing I did was get on the phone to a photographer in the northeast and to the news desk and to try and get somebody down there to get a picture, because then you've got evidence, of course. But by the time they got there, it was too late. So I sort of pursued it, spoke some more to the people that had spotted him, and spoke to our northeast editor, Jeremy Armstrong, who sort of sat and went back through his emails and said, oh, actually, I got a tip off about something about Cummings being spotted up here a while back, and he'd kind of checked it out at the time and it hadn't stood up. And then, of course, during COVID, he'd been so busy out and about trying to cover stories on his patch. But he went back to that original source, and then we started contacting locals that we knew and through political contacts and others. And between the two of us, pursued a whole variety of leads. I mean, really kind of old-fashioned journalism, whether it was calling or going in person in Jeremy's case, or trying to sort of persuade people to talk to us, countless calls. I spent so long on the phone. We were pretty sure. We started to build up a picture of him being up there. But number 10 stonewalled, and you know, didn't offer a denial, but kind of didn't really give us anything much to go on. And actually, having worked in Westminster as long as I have, you learn to sort of recognise what these statements and these non-denial denials are actually mean and what they could indicate. So I thought, okay, we are onto something here. We need to keep going. And we pursued the story for weeks and weeks. And then eventually we came to the conclusion that we'd hit a bit of a brick wall, because it's not the sort of story you could run on a single confirmed source. We felt you had to have more than that. And then I had joined the Mirror not that long before from The Guardian, where I was deputy political editor. So I knew lots of people at The Guardian well, and I had a sort of good, trusting working relationship with them. And I got wind through somebody on the ground in County Durham that there was another source who had spotted Cummings outside his parents' house, the so-called ABBA source, because, of course, he was spotted dancing to ABBA, or suddenly listening to ABBA while leaning against his car. And that person agreed to talk to us. And we thought, OK, here we are. But then it turned out that the Guardian, we found out, had already spoken to them. So at that point, it was like, right, we want to get this over the line. We're so close. I assumed that they would think the same. So after much discussion internally at the Mirror, we decided to take the rather unorthodox approach of approaching the Guardian and seeing who we'd also understood had come up against a bit of a brick wall on it, and suggest working together and collaborating. And that was, I mean, I think that took us by surprise. I think Matt Weaver, the reporter at The Guardian that had been doing the story for them, was initially actually a bit fed up that to find out that his potentially great exclusive has been worked on by somebody else. But after some conversations, and when Matt and I first talked, it became clear that we both felt we could work together, and we both had, you know, we had the capacity to trust each other. The Guardian agreed to do it. And obviously it took a wee bit more work than that to get it over the line. But that was kind of the big breakthrough moment.
One of the things that's really striking hearing you tell that story is how slender a thread the story hung from before all of your work actually stacked it up. It could so easily not have become a story. Then we would never have had the, you know, the Rose Garden session. We would never maybe have had the Select Committee appearance. Cummings might still be in a job today. Did you find that striking?
And any journalist, you'll know, any journalist will tell you that throughout your career you see huge numbers of, sort of tip-offs and rumours, speculation, most of which you try and check out, and much of which amounts to nothing, either because it is just that, a rumour, or because you haven't been able to get the story over the line, you haven't managed to stand up the sourcing, you haven't got a key bit of information, there's something missing. But from the minute I heard it, I thought, you know what? There's something in this. I mean, Dominic Cummings doesn't play by the sort of the normal rules, if you like. And it kind of struck a chord and made me think, you know, actually, it would be a crazy thing to do if you were the architect of those rules to then go on and break them. But actually, the one person who might is Dominic Cummings. And then the more sort of effort we put into it, the more sort of glimmers of insight we got, and people we spoke to, who even if we couldn't use them for the story, kind of gave us some sort of hope that we were onto something. It all very, very slowly, painstakingly came together. I mean, I remember lying in bed at night, and I've not ever had this about another story thing apart from covering the Iraq war, and lying there and racking my brains about this and just not being able to stop thinking about it, because I knew there was something in it and I just couldn't see a way of getting over the line.
The story was published. It was dismissed by the PM as palpably false, and it wasn't false. It was obviously true. And then you found out the Barnard Castle details, the day trip that Mr. Cummings made for more than 30 miles. Was that very satisfying? It's a slightly leading question, isn't it?
Well, there was so much obfuscation throughout that it was very difficult, and there were sort of various different threads to our story, and it wasn't clear which bits were being denied and which weren't. You know, number 10 was strikingly unhelpful, as you might expect, and Dominic Cummings didn't put out any sort of official denial the night we ran the story, but emerged from his house and dismissed it on the Saturday morning as being something that, you know, he didn't use the words Westminster bubble, but that was, you know, his insinuation. People wouldn't care about this. Who cares about this? Well, actually, masses of people did care about it, because it was sort of the most profound shared experience we as a nation have been through probably since the war. And I don't think I'm overstating that. There was kind of literally everybody was making sacrifices. And for some people, it would just be, you know, having to stay at home and not see their friends. For others, it was really much more serious. They weren't able to be with their loved ones when they died. They weren't able to travel across the country for, you know, to help out in family crises. So it kind of touched on everyone's lives. And it was fascinating to me that somebody that regarded themselves as being in touch with how the country, you know, the sort of the beating heart of the country and how people felt about things, was so out of touch on this, just didn't realise how much it would penetrate. To then finally have the sort of admission from Cummings in the Rose Garden at number 10 that he had gone up, and then these extraordinary details about testing his eyesight on the trip to Barnard Castle, which, you know, was something he volunteered rather than, a claim that we had made. I mean, I think you've seen in his recent testimony to the Health and Science Select Committees that he thinks they could have handled it very differently, and he wished he'd been more honest up front. It certainly wasn't a very good strategic call for them, was it?
Pippa, congratulations on the story. It's a fabulous one, and I hope you enjoy the virtual ceremony.
Thank you. Looking forward to it.
I'm Robert Smith. I'm a reporter at the Financial Times.
So, Rob, in a nutshell, can you tell us what the story is that has got you this nomination for the Paul Foote Award?
It's actually quite difficult because it's kind of a sprawling financial scandal, and it's, I guess it's all about the intersection of politics and high finance. So it's in the Financial Times sweet spot. But essentially, Lex Greensill, this Australian financier who said he was sort of reinventing an age-old form of finance through sort of technology and this sort of thing, actually his business turned out to be a house of cards, and it collapsed this year after, you know, the FT and some other journalists had been raising red flags about it for years. But then I guess what took it to the mainstream was we exposed that David Cameron, who was sort of his in-house emissary of influence, shall we say, had been harassing the Treasury to completely rewrite a sort of COVID loan scheme for Greensill's benefit. So that sort of took it box office, shall we say.
Yeah, absolutely. That, I think, is where most people will have come into contact with it, is seeing David Cameron texting everyone and their mums to try and get Greensill some access. So you've been writing about this for years, though.
Yeah.
Can you take us back to how you first noticed Lex Greensill, you know, a very charismatic guy with a wonderful origin story, family of watermelon farmers, suddenly realizes he can use his watermelon farming methods to reimagine finance? It's so compelling.
So bizarrely, the first time I wrote the word Greensill in a story was before the FT. It was in 2014, so like years ago. So there was a big financial shenanigans story in Spain that I wrote about very early in my career. I was only 25 at the time. And Greensill was like a small piece of that puzzle. And then flash forward years later, 2018, my colleague Mike Pooler, he came over to my desk and was like, oh, I'm writing a story about this guy, Sanjeev Gupta. Sanjeev Gupta, for listeners who don't know, is this Indian industrialist whose business is now under investigation by the Serious Fraud Office. But at that time, he was buying loads of stuff. And it was like, how is he doing this? And Mike mentioned he was using this technique called supply chain finance, which was Greensill's signature technique. So I said, oh, I know about that. There's a bloke called Lex Greensill who's a bit interesting, shall we say. And then Mike said, oh, yeah, he's the guy giving up to all the money.
Wow. And, so even then the flags were kind of amber in your eyes, if not actively red. Can you explain in 20 seconds how supply chain finance works, what the basic element of it is? Is it delaying payments?
A lot of companies are really rubbish at paying their bills on time, often just for boring bureaucratic reasons. So in supply chain finance, a finance company, typically a bank, pays the suppliers up front on behalf of the company, but pays them at a small discount. So, you know, knock a pound off the £100 or whatever. And then they collect the full money from the company. Now, the key problem with this is this transaction looks like debt, it smells like debt, it feels like debt. You owe money to a bank, but it's not debt. So if you start doing this for, like, shall we say, racier companies, you can see how a financial product which disguises your debt might have some quite nefarious uses.
Do you think that kind of specialism in your work is what was key to uncovering the story so much earlier than everyone else?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, as I said, it's like the intersection of politics and high finance. But the thing is, it's loads of different nooks and crannies of finance. So it's banking, insurance, sort of niche debt markets, asset management. So, you know, you need that kind of FT sprawling network. And also, it's a story where, like, details matter. Lex Greensill and Sanjeev Gupta are very good at using what I'd call linguistic arbitrage, sort of giving you a statement which is literally true to the letter, but there's a catch somewhere. So to catch these people out, you need to be on top of the details.
Did you find the nature of the story changing when it moved out of those financial realms and into the realm of David Cameron's one-man lobbying blitzkrieg on Whitehall? Did that change the kind of reporting that you had to do?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so we'd always known about this. I mean, hilariously, we asked Greensill Capital in 2019 about Cameron's shareholding, and they said on record he does not own a single share in Greensill Capital, which presumably there was some kind of linguistic arbitrage going on there. So we'd always known about this, but I guess what took us sort of naive finance reporters by surprise was when we got, you know, Jim Pickard and our sort of politics team involved. Just stuff that was very obvious to us, like, oh, well, Lex Greensill used to have a sort of office in Downing Street back in the day. And Jim was like, what? Really?
Right.
So sort of all this stuff that we'd kind of taken for granted, I guess having Jim's perspective, he was like, this is not normal. Like, none of this is normal, Rob. So, yeah, it kind of took us by surprise how sort of big it blew up, I suppose.
To a lot of people, this story might sound as if it's in a very airy and insubstantial realm of large amounts of debt, money moving seamlessly here and there, and it's quite hard to make it tangible. Can you sum up why the story matters, I guess?
Yeah, I think the story matters really because of Sanjeev Gupta, right? So this guy who was bankrolled by Greensill to the tune of $5 billion, like, you know, that's not chump change. You know, he employs 35,000 steelworkers around the world. You know, he's now battling off creditors trying to drive him into insolvency. He's under investigation from the SFO. He owns a bank, which we at the Financial Times revealed had been largely lending to himself. That bank has now been effectively shut down by the Bank of England. You know, this is real stuff. You know, it's not just high finance and sort of intangible derivatives moving around. This is people's livelihoods at stake. You know, there's a criminal investigation into Greensill's bank in Germany. You know, this is like tangible stuff.
And then when you get to the lobbying element of it, I suppose it becomes a question of who is being listened to and who is receiving governmental support, and then who isn't, solely due to their connections.
100%. I mean, Rishi Sunak at Select Committee said that there was no beneficial treatment offered to Greensill because of Cameron, which is, I mean, even like Mel Stride, the sort of Tory chair of it, found this a bit ludicrous. I can't remember his exact words, but he kind of poured a bit of cold water on that. But yeah, I mean, it's incredible that they had meeting after meeting after meeting. You know, this is March, the height of, you know, us all being scared about out of our wits around coronavirus, right? And they had meeting after meeting with really detailed proposals to, like, tinker with this scheme for their benefit. It's pretty bracing when you look at the sort of volume of interaction they had.
Hello, I'm Felicity Lawrence and one of the Guardian Investigations team. So the team's been working for the last 12 months, and it includes me, David Kahn, Rob Evans, David Pegg, Juliet Garside, and some additional reporting by Rupert Neat, all of us at The Guardian. And we've worked in collaboration with people like Peter Gagan of Open Democracy. It began really at the beginning of the COVID crisis and the lockdown sort of period, when the government was giving itself emergency powers, and the investigations team at The Guardian started to recognise familiar names among the people getting contracts without tender. And so we began a whole series of pieces trying to hold them to account for the billions of pounds of taxpayers' money they were going to spend, and just keeping track of who was getting the money and how often it was going to friends and connections of the Tory party.
It's really interesting that you say you noticed familiar names cropping up as people who were in receipt of millions and millions of pounds for these contracts. Do you think that kind of institutional memory was what gave you the start in the first place? Or do you think it would have been possible even without that?
I think the institutional memory is hugely important, and it kind of really underlines just, you know, the value of having a resource of investigative journalism that's digging away constantly. So one of the first big contracts, which ended up with hundreds of millions of pounds going to a company called Randox in Northern Ireland for testing, came up quite quickly, and my colleagues Rob Evans and David Pegg and I had already worked on that company and the fact that it was paying Owen Paterson, former Environment Secretary, £100,000 a year as a consultant, and that he had been lobbying for them. So we were immediately alert alert to it. I think you could have done it without, but I just think it was very difficult. The information is well hidden. Contracts are published, but quite obscurely. And so what we were able to bring to it, which was new as well, was to work with our digital data investigations people who helped us scrape databases on a daily basis and alerted us to stuff. So it was kind of a mixture of people who already knew the territory, spotted the patterns, and lots of new kinds of ways of working coming in from other members of the team.
I wonder if you could tell me a bit about the high priority lane. I found that very interesting.
Yes, well, of course, we didn't discover that till later. The line had always been, we thought that what we could see was a sort of Trumpocracy emerging on a kind of quite unprecedented scale because COVID presented so many opportunities. And to be fair to the government, obviously, there was the most enormous amount of work to do in a crisis situation and an emergency. Ministers always denied that they favoured anyone, but it began to emerge that there was this VIP lane. And one of the things we did, where another colleague, David Conn, with the team, published a piece about a contract given to Public First, which was a company that had been founded by two people who'd worked with the Tory party closely and were and with Dominic Cummings and Michael Gove and were friends. It was said that that was nothing to do with it. That was the line that we were given. But when we published, we joined with forces with various other people, including the Good Law Project, who used what we had published to prepare a court case before the High Court to challenge the legality of quite a lot of these contracts. In the course of that, the Good Law Project uncovered this VIP lane, where if you had a connection with a politician, a minister, or a senior civil servant, or an advisor, you were referred through to this VIP lane. And of course, the problem with that is once you know that that's actually how you get contracts, lots of people who felt they had just as much to offer, if not more, didn't even get through the sort of first hurdle of the form on the website. And so if people start thinking that the way you get government deals is by having a friend, it's a sort of invitation to corruption and bending of the rules.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because that is how it seems these things start. Is, well, it's a crisis. We're scrambling around. We've got to take all offers from as many people as possible. And then it seems to have become something a bit more formalized with the introduction of this this high priority lane. And that's where the trouble really, really starts to set in. Or so it seems.
Yes, and I think that's a whole attitude. I mean, a lot of people, civil servants are deeply troubled by what's going on and say, there might have been some justification for speeding up stuff at the beginning. But it's a lot. It's been going on a long time. They feel that there's no justification for not having due process after a month, a couple of months. I think there is the sort of sense within this particular government that they are not going to be held to account, that they know better, and that their friends are the best people at doing this, so they don't even try. And that is deeply shocking. I think there is a sort of cronyism has taken hold.
And my final question, I suppose, is what is the next frontier for these stories?
Well, I think one of the things that's happened with COVID is people have gotten to a pattern of behaviour. So it may be that there's less of the COVID type of contract story, but it will be up to us to see and hold the government to account if it carries on behaving like this with other stuff. And I think that is a really live danger around reforms of public service, the health service, education, what they're doing with appointing friends to, say, departmental boards. This cronyism is not confined to COVID. COVID's provided a climate in which it can be accelerated. And then once it's taken hold, I think it will be quite hard to get rid of it.
Hello, I'm Jack Schenker and I'm a freelance journalist. And my piece, Death at the Ministry, was for the slow news platform Tortoise.
So, Jack, your story starts with a man called Emmanuel Gomez. Can you tell us a little more about him?
Yeah, so Emmanuel Gomez was somebody who worked at the very heart of government in a role that rarely gets mentioned when we talk about politics. He wasn't an MP or a minister or a special advisor. He was a cleaner, an outsourced cleaner at that. So someone who swept the corridors and scrubbed the toilets in the Ministry of Justice, doing hard, essential work, but to many people, invisible work, day in, day out. And when the pandemic started, Emmanuel and his colleagues were ordered to continue coming in and cleaning, even though nearly all of the ministry's civil servants were now working from home. And my piece tries to explore what happened next in those confused and terrifying days, where the government was publicly venerating key workers right at the outset of the COVID crisis, but actually treating them very differently behind its own walls. It charts the cleaners who were increasingly scared about their isolation at the heart of this big empty building, and the fact that some of them were beginning to fall ill with coronavirus-like symptoms, demanding clarification from managers who had disappeared and were absent, requesting PPE that never arrived. And crucially, because of their employment structure via this outsourcing firm, which denies them many of the basic workers' rights that we expect from people on full-time employment contracts, they pointed out that if any of them were to get sick, because they're only entitled to statutory sick pay, which is not enough to live on, unless extra support was offered, they would be forced to keep on coming into work and risk spreading the sickness around the staff, which is exactly what happened. We know for a fact that at least 7 ancillary workers at the Ministry of Justice fell sick with symptoms consistent with coronavirus, 2 of whom, including Emmanuel Gomez, ended up, unfortunately, dying. And the investigation ostensibly focuses on that death, but I think the story of what happened to Emmanuel is really a story about who gets seen and valued in our society and who isn't and why. And it reveals a great deal about the sort of country that the COVID crisis landed in, and also the battle over what sort of country will emerge on the other side.
It's a fascinating piece to read. It's really extraordinary. And you had to do a great amount of reporting around the world in the story, focusing on the story of one man's death. Emmanuel was born in Guinea-Bissau. His family were in Portugal. He was here in London, and he had to keep working throughout this. And you had to do a great deal of translation and communication around the planet, I believe.
Yeah, the logistical challenges in getting this investigation off the ground were pretty immense. I mean, for a start, it was, as I said, the early days of the first lockdown when we were all adjusting to this new reality. And of course, there were restrictions on movement. And in particular, Emmanuel's wife, who had flown over from Lisbon to try, initially, to track down her husband's body, as well as his belongings, both of which had been swallowed up into this eerie, quite scary sort of pandemic era bureaucracy of death. In many ways, somewhat ironically, it felt as if the state took greater care of Emmanuel's body and belongings in his death than they ever did of him in his life. So we ended up, me and some colleagues, accompanying Nanetta, that's Emmanuel's wife, around different parts of East London, from coroner's courts to emergency morgues to police stations. And added to that logistical challenge was, of course, as you say, the matter of translation. Emmanuel's colleagues at the Ministry of Justice hail from all over the world, but especially different parts of sub-Saharan Africa and South America. They work shifts. It was very difficult to find times when we could meet people, and we had to do so close to the ministry, but out of sight of suspicious managers, which led to lots of sort of clandestine huddles in St. James's Park in the shadows. And we also had to overcome the fact that people were communicating in multiple languages. And not only did we want to do those interviews, obviously, in those languages, but we also wanted to make sure that the workers who were taking a huge risk in speaking out, many of them were willing to be named publicly in the piece. We wanted to make sure that they fully understood what we were writing and had a sense of control and ownership over the story, which was really about their battle ongoing for a sense of justice and accountability. And so as we went along, we were translating bits of the story, bits of the stuff I was writing, so that they could read and give their feedback.
This is a story which as well as its effect on individuals, is also, as you say, systemic. Can you tell me a bit more about the employment status that Emmanuel had?
Absolutely. And it's important to say that Emmanuel's employment situation wasn't an anomaly. It's very built into the very structure that, you know, our government wants to use when employing kind of ancillary workers. And obviously outsourcing is an issue that Private Eye has covered brilliantly over the years. But despite the fact that Emmanuel worked at the Ministry of Justice, carrying out contractual duties which are specified by the Ministry of Justice, and the fact that Emmanuel ultimately gets paid via a taxpayer contract, which is channeled through the Ministry of Justice, his employers were technically a private company called OCS, which is owned by the Goodliffe family, who, according to the Sunday Times Rich List, are worth £191 million. It's very difficult to get much public information on them. And the contract between OCS and the Ministry of Justice, which, as I say, is funded by taxpayers, is largely shielded from public view by commercial confidentiality sources. And what that employment layer allows the ministry to do is to ultimately deny responsibility for the welfare and rights of the people cleaning its offices, because it can always say that those are in the domain of OCS. And it allows OCS to often get around accusations of mistreatment or, you know, not respecting workers' rights by saying that they were merely doing what they were asked to do by the Ministry of Justice. And we saw this at the time. We've seen emails. We've interviewed multiple workers and got corroborating testimony of communications between workers and their managers saying, I'm really concerned about this situation. Our colleagues are ill with what seems like COVID. They're dropping like flies. I'm feeling ill. I need to take time off, but I'm scared I won't be able to pay my rent. And you constantly see, and we have the email chain for this, a passing of the buck back and forth between MOJ, the Ministry of Justice, and OCS.
Can you tell me what's changed since your story was published?
Yeah, so within a couple of days of the investigation being published, the Ministry of Justice backed down on the issue of COVID-era sick pay, having long denied that it had any responsibility over the those kind of benefits and rights of the workers cleaning its building. It then instantly turned around and said that it was going to be applying sick pay, full sick pay, to its outsourced workers during the COVID era, and it would retrospectively back pay those mentioned in our article who, you know, were denied that pay when they stayed at home. And it also, several months later, thanks to the ongoing courage of Emmanuel's colleagues, many of whom actually walked out on a wildcat strike on International Workers' Memorial Day to highlight what had happened to Emmanuel and what they thought was an avoidable death. The Ministry of Justice has now recognised their trade union, United Voices of the World, as a recognised trade union within that workplace. And that's a real step forward, because this is the kind of workforce that is largely non-English speaking. It's fragmented. It's precarious. People are on shift work. Their employment is insecure. It's very, very hard. It's been thought that it was very, very hard to get workers to organize together, to recognize themselves as a collective, and to stand up to management in those kind of situations. And the fact that these workers have done so is a huge step forward. The battle isn't over. They're still fighting for a living wage and basic rights and for better safety at work. But that's the reason why this story, as well as being quite intense and traumatic at times to report, was to me ultimately an uplifting one as well.
My name's Harriet Clugston, and I'm a data investigations editor.
I'm Ethan Schoen. I'm the politics reporter for National World, part of JPI Media.
Harriet, can you tell me a little bit about your investigation?
Yeah, so the investigation, basically, we took the fact that in 2015, we had this big comprehensive bit of legislation passed. It was supposed to be groundbreaking, the Modern Slavery Act 2015, to tackle slavery and human trafficking into and within the UK. And there was a lot of grand promises made at the time, very strong political rhetoric about how it was going to crack down on this crime and sort of tackle the issue in all of our communities. And so we wanted to have a look at what was the reality. 6 years after that legislation, have the promises been kept? the sort of answers that we found were no, that they haven't, and that essentially post-legislation, things have been going wrong in every part of the system, whether it's prosecutions or convictions or it's supporting victims of the crime. So there's a particular quote we honed in on for Theresa May, for instance, when she introduced it at the time, saying that the bill would send the strongest possible message to criminals, that if you're involved in this disgusting trade in human beings, you'll be arrested, you'll be prosecuted, and you'll be locked up. And our project essentially tried to ask and answer whether that had transpired, and the answer was no, it had not.
So one of the first things your investigation identified was about the number of charges being brought and the number of convictions being made for modern slavery. What was going on there?
We started with the data that we knew existed that was in the public domain. I'm primarily a data journalist, so I was familiar with this already. So the Home Office police recorded crime sort of database that they have, we analysed that since 2015, so since the modern slavery offences started appearing, and found that there'd been 19,000 offences recorded across Great Britain, actually. We've got some FOI data from Scotland too. So 19,000 had been recorded and closed without charges being brought. And that was actually more than 19 in 20 cases. So the charge rate has been less than 5% since it came in. And it's actually been dropping every year. So when you look at just the first 6 months of the 2020-2021 financial year, for instance, it had fallen to 2%. So it was very clear that prosecutions were not forthcoming, and huge regional disparities as well. So got some forces where it's 0%. And then on the other hand, the Lancashire Police, which was the most successful, was almost 30%. So there's lots of difficulties clearly going on with police bringing charges.
Why is the legislation failing so badly?
I think there are a few possible answers, some of them kind of more cynical than the others. To an extent, there are clearly operational difficulties in kind of tackling this kind of crime. But what makes it more difficult is when certain steps that might make it easier to investigate are not taken, such as screening migrants and people who've made small boat crossings or who've really made their way into the UK by anything less than entirely legitimate means. A widespread failure to screen those people for signs of modern slavery, which is what we found particularly during last summer, which was a kind of bumper year for attempted crossings and successful crossings of the Channel.
This kind of interesting thing going on where there's, you know, on the one hand, you're sort of thinking, is this a systemic failure, you know, with the legislation at its heart and, you know, sort of what's passed down from the Home Office. And there's also the fact that, you know, you've got these regional disparities. So some police forces are doing a better job than others. But I think, you know, one of the things the charities and experts we talked to were sort of really keen to highlight was that there is, as well as a need for better training, because there's quite a lot of lack of understanding, there's sort of these statutory responsibilities have been introduced that police officers and social workers, etc., have got to follow. But, you know, in reality, a lot of them don't actually understand or even know about things like the referral mechanism. But there's also a sort of lack of a holistic approach almost. So it's sort of looking at the cogs, but not looking at the people who are caught up in it. And, you know, a lack of support holistically for victims has a knock-on effect in that they're less willing to cooperate with the police. And when the police already say that these are some of the most complicated crimes they'll ever sort of have to investigate, if they don't have a willing victim on board or a victim who's too scared because they've not been given any reason or, you know, they can't see the positive side for them to sort of to cooperate, you're really sort of fighting a losing battle.
Ethan, where would you like to see this story go next?
I think that unfortunately, as you pointed out earlier, it doesn't seem that this is a case of people getting to grips with legislation over time. It seems to me as though actually what will though existed initially to kind of tackle this, as it was a project that was kind of pushed forward by a particular set of people, particularly Theresa May was quite keen to push this through, and I worry that will is kind of lacking now and is reducing. And I certainly from the aspect of it which I investigated, which was more to do with borders, I see a number of issues which are getting worse. I mean, something that we're looking at and we continue to look at after this investigation is the Home Office trying to prosecute as supposed kind of perpetrators of modern trafficking and organisers of it, people who have who are just migrants who've been put onto a boat by people traffickers. And when they're picked up, the fact that they happen to be steering the boat, for instance, is given as cause to prosecute them as the organisers of these things. And now we're already seeing on appeal some of these prosecutions kind of falling away. But that, you know, that's one area in which it seems that none of the lessons that could have been learned from the last 5 years of policy in this area have been learned. And if anything, we're going the other way. I mean, the other thing I think to say is that part of the problem is this, it's a vicious loop. I think it's a vicious cycle in that there is little trust among many of these victims anyway, because they, yeah, their interactions with the state have often not been particularly helpful, whether that's because they're, you know, whether that's in a UK context or whether that's because they've come from another country where their, again, their interactions with law enforcement particularly can be, yeah, pretty rough. I mean, I spoke to experts, it's often not happening, but who are aware of many cases where traffickers use that and they utilise that fear of law enforcement. I'm aware of a case where a victim, as soon as they were brought over to the UK, they were kind of quite badly beaten up by what they thought at the time were two police officers, but it was actually people who had been kind of paid by the traffickers to dress as police officers, to more deeply instill that that fear of authority. But from the other side, what doesn't help to kind of get rid of that is the prioritising of a hostile environment over looking after and trying to support victims of modern slavery or other forms of severe exploitation, because it falls into, yeah, one of several types of severe exploitation. And even those people who have gone through horrific ordeals, the criteria for someone to be a specific victim of modern slavery is quite narrow.
In terms of where I'd like to see it go, one of the things we did call for in the investigation was the fact that back in 2019, the Home Affairs Select Committee was in fact undertaking an inquiry into modern slavery and human trafficking out of a recognition of the fact that, you know, the system is riddled with problems, you know, right from police investigation through to victim support through to compensation. And when the Parliament was dissolved for the general election in 2019, Home Affairs Select Committee dissolved with it, and they've never picked up that inquiry since. They've sort of focused on COVID, Brexit, etc. But, you know, as the people we spoke to pointed out, those two things mean that modern slavery has evolved. And, it seems that, you know, they had hundreds of submissions of evidence to that inquiry and it's just sitting there. So I would really like to see that inquiry.
So, there you have it. Those are the seven brilliant stories and investigations that have been shortlisted for this year's award. All of them absolutely fabulous. We are now going to go as live, not actually live, because the award ceremony was very, very recently, but as live, we're going to go over to Ian Hislop to announce the winner. Here's Ian.
Judges at award ceremonies quite often say, the standard of entries was so high, we found it so difficult to choose. But this year, the judges on the Foot Award really meant it, and they forced me to add an extra category. So this year, there is a highly commended as well as a winner, which is a genuine tribute to the quality of the entries, but also quite annoying because it means I have to shell out more money. But never mind. I am genuinely delighted that we have a highly commended award, and it was unanimously agreed by the judges that this should go to Jack Schenker at Tortoise. Everyone was agreed that amongst the larger narratives of the COVID pandemic, this was a classic pull-foot story of an ordinary person, an underdog, the cleaner Emmanuel Gomez, who died and was let down by all of those who were meant to protect him. And the ultimate irony being that it took a journalist to get justice for someone employed in the Ministry of Justice. So congratulations to Jack Schenker from Tortoise, highly commended in this year's awards. So this year's winner is... Yeah, Dave, I said don't ring me here. It's too late. It's not going to make any difference. You can't just ring me up. They're not going to change their decision. Sorry, no. The winner is... Robert Smith and his team at the FT for the unravelling of Lex Greensill. Robert, congratulations. Now, I hope you can see this is a cheque. It's your winning cheque, and it's a bit Bashir, let's be honest. It's a bit forged. But there will be a real cheque coming into you to say a brilliant win. You could tell at the judges' meeting that you were going to win because I just measure how jealous everybody else is around the table. And there was a lot of feeling, and one or two people said it. Well, we've all been trying to nail one of these revolving door stories without actually just saying, look, it's happening, isn't it awful? But you actually got one where you could tell it there was cause and effect. It literally made sense, which was obviously very satisfying.
And I should stress, like, I'm not the only winner. I'm splitting that lovely $5,000 check with five other people. So Mike Pooler, Cynthia Omerchu, Jim Pickard, Olaf Storbeck, and Arash Masoudi. And they're just a small subset of like the cast of thousands who did this story at the FT.
Well, I mean, hats off to them. I mean, and again, to get a story that's about supply chain finance, which again, many of us might have thought this isn't top of what we're going to read. I mean, requires not just digging skills, but presenting skills and you know, proper journalistic skills.
No, totally. And look, there's people behind the scenes as well. So like, so Tom Braithwaite, Richard Blackton, there are companies, news editors, and they just got this story from the get-go, which, as you say, isn't, you know, I've got a sexy story about supply chain finance. It doesn't always seem that way. And then also, I have to say, the hardest working man at the FT, our in-house lawyer, Nigel Hansen, particularly in 2019, he had to field a lot of correspondence from
central offices. Good grief. We're actually having a credit to a lawyer.
I mean,
I'm going to have to stop.
Nigel has saved my bacon on like too many occasions to mention. So, yeah, thanks, Nigel.
Okay, well, we did think, I mean, the judges collectively thought that there were some brilliant individual stories, but there were quite a lot of good mainstream national papers, I mean, including the FT, really going for it this year, which might surprise people in a year when there were so many challenges.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I don't think journalists should be like high up on people's sympathy lists during the coronavirus, obviously, but like, it's been a lot harder to sort of break news and hold people to account from your bedroom, right, or wherever it is. So I mean, it is amazing, like, looking down the list, like, the strength of stories this year. And, you know, we all kind of, you know, we know this is a good story, the Green Source story is a good story, but we're amazed we've won when we look at, you know, things like Barnard Castle, you know, the Insight team's piece on Boris missing all the Cobra meetings. It's kind of incredible how heavy hitting some of the stories have been given the conditions we've been reporting under.
One of the qualities of your investigation was, as you point out, that it's been going on a long time, and Footy was always very happy to keep repeating and keep adding and keep accreting, as it were, until you got a real momentum behind a story. So it was very much that sort of story. And again, I think he was very interested very early on in this idea of the revolving door, in which we, again, even in this issue, there's loads more of it, but in this idea that this really isn't acceptable and the way people are conducting themselves right at the heart of government. And I think that's what you found. It was literally inside number 10, wasn't it?
Yeah, indeed. And I mean, it's quite funny because some of us financial reporters on the story, we'd actually known a lot of this for a long time. But because it was outside of our bailiwick, I guess we didn't realise how awful and brazen and shocking it was until we got our sort of politics guys on board. And they were like, wait, he had an office in Downing Street and a business card and no real role? You know, we've been tenaciously following this story for a long time, and it's been sort of amazing to see it all blow up this year.
And the other thing the judges were very keen to stress is just the effect of the story. Mm. I mean, not just the quality of the journalism going into it and the dedication of diligence, but really just the shockwaves. Were you surprised that it just keeps going? You know, civil servants, some of them work for someone else, do they? that was news.
I mean, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff which is apparently common practice, which we didn't realise until this blew it up. Like, I mean, I think I always knew, like, Greensill, the company, was a house of cards. It's something like our head investigations, Paul Murphy, once said to me, actually. He said, the thing about houses of cards is they tend to look like houses of cards. And this really did look like a house of cards. I think it was the scale of the political embarrassment that kind of took us by surprise. And I think we have to thank David Cameron for that, because he ignored our phone calls for over 30 days and I think made it a lot worse for himself in the process. So thanks for that, David.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, I think he was just sort of payback, really, because a lot of people ignored his over the years. And we have got to a point where, again, I think, and all credit to you guys for essentially saying that a supply chain finance problem between two departments of government could be solved by someone just paying their bills on time. That did cut through.
It did seem to be a solution in search of a problem, right? Why you needed Lex Greensill to be in the middle of all this was baffling to us, but apparently wasn't baffling to some very smart civil servants. So I don't know. Maybe they saw something us mere journalists couldn't see.
I'm once tempted to say they saw a large payoff, but I think that would probably be unfair, wouldn't it?
No comment.
Excellent. Well, no FT, no comment. We finally got there. thank you very much again, and very, very well done.
Thanks, Ian. Thank you.
So that's it for this episode of Page 94. Congratulations once again to Robert and to all the other nominees for their brilliant stories and investigations. As for us, we will be back again next episode before too long. Look out for it in your podcast apps or wherever you get your podcasts from. Until then, it only remains to remind you that the magazine is also available with huge reams of investigative journalism at a very reasonable rate. Thank you for listening once more. Goodbye.